The highly charged debate over the proposed Islamic center in Lower Manhattan has attracted the attention of young Muslims who visit Islamic websites and post messages in jihadi chat rooms. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston reports some experts worry the controversy plays into the hands of extremists.
As originally conceived, the idea behind the Islamic center in downtown Manhattan seemed simple enough.
Well, there will be a 500-seat auditorium, there'll be a swimming pool, there'll be athletic facilities, there'll be cooking classes.
That's Daisy Khan on ABC's This Week. She's the wife of the imam in charge of the proposed center. She envisioned the 13-floor building like a YMCA, except it would be Muslim and would include a small mosque.
Education, forums, conferences, and it's basically become a place where ideas can be exchanged, but tolerance, mutual respect can also be extended.
Instead, what Daisy Khan got was this.
And we will never, ever allow these laws to be stopped.
Dueling demonstrations on Sunday outside Park 51, the proposed site for the center.
We don't have a decency or compassion when it comes to respecting those who died.
Hundreds of people showed up. Families of the 9/11 victims called the center an affront to what they considered hallowed ground. Construction workers vowed not to help build it. Civil liberties groups chanted about religious tolerance. And the police did their best to keep the two sides on opposite sides of the street. That's how the debate is playing out publicly. Out in the blogosphere, in password-protected web forums run by extremists, there's a different view. All this controversy is welcomed. Extremists and radical clerics, including one who has become a kind of bug light of sorts attracting young American jihadis, have posted a stream of I told you so messages. They've long claimed that Islam was under attack by the West. The violent reaction to the center, they say, now proves it.
This unfortunately is playing right into their hand, and as such, they are encouraging it with glee.
Evan F. Coleman tracks jihadi websites and chat rooms for Flashpoint Global Partners, a New York-based security firm. He says that extremists couldn't have scripted events any better, and they've made clear that they hope the debate rages on.
It's their sense that by doing this, that Americans are going to alienate American Muslims to the point where even relatively moderate Muslims are going to be pushed into joining extremist movements like Al-Qaeda.
And that worries law enforcement. There have been a record number of homegrown terrorist plots in this country since late last year. Officials say the long wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have moved some young Muslims to join the fight. So far this year, the FBI has intercepted nearly a dozen young American Muslims, allegedly on their way to terrorist training camps in Pakistan or Somalia. And in nearly every case, the young men said America's so-called war on Islam was one of their reasons for leaving. And intelligence officials say that every young Muslim they've intercepted this year has claimed to be inspired by one man, an internet cleric named Anwar al-Awlaki.
To the Muslims in America, I have this to say.
Al-Awlaki, the radical cleric linked to the Fort Hood and Christmas Day attacks, made a direct appeal to American Muslims earlier this summer.
How can you have your loyalty to a government that is leading the war against Islam and Muslims?
I am Brian Fishman. I'm a counterterrorism research fellow at the New America Foundation.
Fishman has been tracking al-Awlaki for years, and he says the latest controversy over the Islamic Center has made al-Awlaki look prescient.
Over the past 9 to 12 months, Anwar al-Awlaki has tried to promote this notion that the West, and particularly the United States, will turn on its Muslim citizens. And some of the anti-Islamic tone that has been going on around the country in connection with the mosque debate feeds into this notion that people like Anwar al-Awlaki can take advantage of.
Given the highly charged environment, that notion is unlikely to change anytime soon. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News, New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. 75 years ago, Adolf Hitler and his henchmen handed down the Nuremberg Laws, a series of measures that codified anti-Semitism in Germany and laid the path to the death camps where 6 million Jews were killed. The legal copies of those laws came into Allied hands at the close of World War II, And General George Patton spirited them, illegally as it happens, out of Germany and turned them over to the Huntington Library in his hometown of San Marino, California. Now the papers are bound for Washington, D.C., and a new home in the National Archives. Stephen Koblick is the president of the Huntington Library, and he joins us from his office. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Well, what's on these pages, these pieces of four typewritten pages, I understand?
There are three different laws that were promulgated. One, a law of the blood. Another, a law of the flag. And there was a third law about citizenship. Forgetting about the law of the flag, which is the putting of the swastika onto the flag, but the other two laws are the really important ones. And what those two laws did was they segregated Germans of Jewish extraction from the rest of the citizenship. When Hitler came to power in January of 1933, he immediately began his anti-Semitic policies. But he did this often through administrative action, or sometimes there would be paramilitary activity with one of the Nazi groups like the stormtroopers. But the legal exclusion of German Jews from normal life in Germany took a lot longer, and 1935, the Nuremberg Laws, were really an important step in isolating the Jews. If you're going to really persecute a group of people, you need to define them.
And how did General Patton get them?
General Patton was a souvenir hunter, and in every campaign, he tried to collect souvenirs because he had hopes and ambitions of building a museum. And so he sent out his intelligence officers to find souvenirs. They happened in the town of Eisenstadt to come to a vault, and they were looking in the vault, and they saw these materials. So they were taken out of the vault and given to Patton's staff, and then Patton's staff officers presented these documents for his as a souvenir. They presented them to Patton.
The Nuremberg Laws are, of course, very well known. And it's not as if there's been a mystery about what was in them until now.
That's exactly right. And from my perspective as a Holocaust scholar, one of the things that's very difficult for most people who are interested in the Holocaust but don't do scholarship on it is that when the decisions were taken to start the Final Solution, which ended up killing over 6 million Jews in Europe, there's almost no documentation of that decision specifically that there's a Hitler signature on. I mean, here we know that Hitler drove this policy, and yet if you look at the, so far anyway, the documentation in 1941, which is when most scholars believe these decisions were taken, we have no specific connection to Hitler. These documents, the Nuremberg Laws, have Hitler's signature, and for me that's important, because it clearly ties him with this policy of persecution of the Jews.
My gosh, what's it like to see Adolf Hitler's signature right in front of your face?
It's a reminder. Studying the Holocaust is an emotional roller coaster ride, because you run into documents that just are deeply disturbing, and that you have to kind of stop, take a breath, sometimes wait a day or a week before you go back to that kind of material, because it's so wrenching. My attitude, of course, to Hitler has, what I guess I would call, hardened over 40 years of studying Nazi Germany. So for me, looking at the document is a confirmation, and the frustration of not being able to find a similar kind of document putting Hitler's signature next to the policy to exterminate the Jews, there's a kind of satisfaction that I can feel that at least in these documents of the Nuremberg Laws, there's a Hitler signature.
Stephen Koblick, president of the Huntington Library in San Marino, California. Steve, thank you so much.
You're welcome.